right. Hey, everyone. Good afternoon. This is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT LPFM 102.7 and 103.9 coming at you live. And that is from the heart of the universe, the very center of the universe. That would be Clear Creek County, Colorado, of course, and in downtown Idaho Spring in this fantastic summer day. We got about 4 days, I think 3 or 4 days to the solstice, but it's feeling it right now. Little toasty, little warmy, and so very happy we're up here in the mountains in here, because we can only imagine how nice and warm it is down there in the flatlands and elsewhere around the country, but it's just like perfect. So if you're looking for a place to come to over the weekend, why, Clear Creek County is the place to be. This is The Rabbit Hole, and we have a special edition today, and it will be Writer's Talk, and with me in the studio is Reese Llewellyn, and we'll be talking with Reese here in a few moments. But before we do, I want to thank all our sponsors. I want to thank Tommy Knockers for the last hour, by the way, for sponsoring that. And without Tommy Knockers and our other sponsors, community radio shows like this, not possible. So thank you all. And this next hour is brought to you by me, Jerry Fabianic, and my work, Sisyphus Wins. You can go to my website to learn more about that at jerryfabianic.com. And I guess, you know, I mean, that's, yeah. So why don't we get the ball rolling here? And as I say, Reese Llewellyn is in the studio with me. And Reese was born in Washington, D.C. It's hard to believe, Reese, anybody was actually born in Washington, D.C. I thought you just got elected and went there.
Well, that's what I've been told anyway. I don't know whether there's any better stories. But yes, we did get live there for a while and then moved to Falls Church, Virginia. And okay. Stayed out there for a number of years. But
super. And you got a psychology degree?
Yeah, received a BA in psychology from William & Mary in Virginia.
Okay, you're going to do an analysis of me?
I've already started. I've been taking notes for the last 5 or 10 minutes, and I've got some serious issues we need to discuss off air, of course. But.
Well, let's discuss them on here. We'll make it even more lively.
All right, yeah. Well, the hospital, actually, I was born in Washington, D.C., was Garfield Memorial Hospital, and they've already torn that down. And then I went to grade school in Falls Church, and one of the schools was actually used in the Civil War as a hospital, and they've torn that down. Mm-hmm. In my high school, I just got word that they're in the process of tearing that down, so they're catching up with me.
Yeah, I'm going to say they're going to, do you feel threatened?
Well, somewhat, beginning to develop a serious paranoia here or something. I keep my back to the wall at all times, I think.
Oh, so. That psychology degree is going to come in.
Oh, it has been very handy, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Well, Llewellyn, that sounds Welsh. Is it a Welsh name?
Yeah, it's a Welsh name. I think over there they pronounce it H L like Llewellyn, but you, if you're out there trying to tell somebody how to pronounce it, they really need to be wearing a raincoat, because it's a kind of a thing when they do that. But yeah, it's a like Llewellyn, and it is Welsh. We've been here since 1750, as far as my father could check it back. I went to Wales, and they said that we could take it back another 300 years if you knew which parish your family came from, but we couldn't do that. So across the big pond, it's been a big difficulty. So,
Oh my gosh, you can trace that history. Well, then you were okay. So you're from Virginia. When did you move here?
Moved to Colorado in 1975. Actually, and been in the same house ever since. Although we did,
they're not going to raise that, are they?
Well, I've kind of start quaking and quivering a little bit when I see the big front end loaders go by, but so far they haven't stopped in front of the house, but I just kind of keep a watchful eye out for that. But we spent 16 winters actually in Florida, down at Sanibel, which on the southwest side, mm-hmm, Gulf Coast, just next to Fort Myers.
So south of Tampa.
Oh, yeah, a couple hours south of Tampa, St. Pete.
Okay. And so, all right, just heading down that way there.
Yeah.
What else did you do? Did you have an alternative life before you got into writing?
mostly keeping up with maintenance issues down in Florida. Everything seemed to mold and mildew and rust, and it finally got too much, and I decided I'd come back here where the living is a little easier. So.
Okay, cool.
But as far as an alternate life, I don't know. Every once in a while you have questions about were you in the Civil War or not. You see certain areas and think, that looks familiar for some reason. But
Maybe a past life.
It could have been. One never knows. So.
Exactly. You know. And when we were talking once before, you were sharing with me that your writing actually goes way back to like junior high.
Well, actually, yeah, probably before that. I think the first real writing exercise was around third grade when I was talking too much in class, and the teacher said, after class, you start writing on the blackboard 100 times, I shall not talk in class. And so, yeah, it kind of got a certain flow to it after that. It got easier, although I think his name was Aloysius Stanley Smolensky or something like that. And he was teaching some sort of holistic thing that day. And so I got to the point where it was getting rather short of space at the bottom. So I used his initials and then abbreviated the subject matter, and that got me in more trouble. So,
what was his name? So,
Aloysius Stanley Slavonovich or something like that.
I
so,
see,
and then the holistic thing after that. So
you made him the butt of your jokes.
Something, that was the end was in sight definitely at that point. he didn't care for that. So then I, had to start all over again. But anyway, that was sort of the beginning of the writing career. And then in high school, I contributed to a little magazine called The Tempo that came out in 1961 with a bunch of people from different grades in our school. So I added a little ditty in there, and it's just a small little humor thing, which I tend to lean more towards.
Hard to tell. You don't have a sense of humor.
No, not. It's been very droll, I guess. So
yeah,
I don't know
exactly. And so, so you were writing even then in this humorous vein. I guess it comes naturally, doesn't it? You find humor situations.
I was in a writing group here in Evergreen some years ago, and we had different things to write about. And the first time the instructor said, well, write about something that happened early on in your life, so I wrote a little short story about a visit with Nina, which was the name of my dentist at the time when I was quite young, and she didn't believe in Novocaine, and she was only charging $5 a filling, so my dad thought that was a great deal. So
heck yeah.
So anyway, I wrote a kind of a little tongue-in-cheek, pardon the pun, but little story about my visit with Nina.
And I got you going back in again.
Yeah, it's when it's fun to write, that's when you should write. And in Florida, I was in a writer's group, and they'd say, well, let's pick a topic. And one time, it was right about flowers, so I wrote a poem called The Victory Garden. And that was quite amusing, at least I thought so, and the rest of the group did. So I think that's where the creativity comes in. You just pick a topic and see what you can develop out of it. But so I enjoy doing that. So humor, as I say, is the type that I like the best.
Mm-hmm. So. Did your head kind of spin with like puns and
metaphors? You bet.
And...
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. It's just... the one on flowers, for instance, it was always rhyming with some type of flower and things like that. It's kind of a macabre type of poem, but I won't go further. it's kind of funny. So.
Yeah, you can give them names, like Peggy Petunia, Jerry Geranium.
A guy who had Freud as a neighbor and had a problem with this flower garden because there were no insects or bees around it, and it turned out all the flowers were carnivorous. And so Freud was asked to go in there, and then he came back analyzed all the problems about these particular flowers. It's pretty funny, but
oh, is it, you know, kind of like the Venus flytrap
sort
of thing?
Yeah, something like that. So pretty cute. But anyway, so you pick a topic and you write about it, and if you can laugh, then that's the main thing. So.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. And what was your first serious venture into writing? Neptune's Treasure?
I would say that was the first, and I would say it was one where I really took a chance. I had never done an actual book before. It was usually just poem or a little short story, but we had a friend down there.
Down where?
I'm sorry, in Sanibel, Florida. When we first moved down there, we went. Our next door neighbor told us to. She'd like to go fossiling with us, and we'd never done that. So we would wade out waist deep in the Peace River down there, and prayed that the alligators wouldn't come
out. Chomp.
Oh yeah.
That would be humorous.
We'd like to find them before they found us.
But see a suitcase coming by.
Or something like that, or a nice pair of shoes or whatever be great, but it's really rough. But anyway, so we took our finds into his shop. It was called Neptune's Treasures, and he was kind of a gruff appearance guy, you know, sort of roly-poly, and had a kind of strange demeanor, like you didn't know how to approach him, but he was really a teddy bear. So he'd tell us what we found, whether it was a horse tooth, shark's tooth, alligator tooth, or whatever. And so we got to going in there a lot and became good friends, and we'd help him out in his shop. And he'd call us up and say, "Hey, I got this great stuff. You ought to come in and take a look at it." So, you know, we'd end up spending hours. He was a fantastic guy. He was self-taught, but he knew the name of all the scientific name of all the seashells, and he was just so enthusiastic about life and about what the Earth and the oceans had to offer. And he was one of the first certified divers in Southwest Florida. And he began after he came out of the military, he began to go diving in around the area, and he'd collect shells when you could collect them live, and he would sell them to the local shell dealers. Then eventually he made enough money to open his own shop, and he was there for 25 years. Mm-hmm. And he was an icon on the island down there. So at one point, though, he had a massive stroke, left him almost completely paralyzed, and he asked us if we would sell out his store. So we did. It took us 11 months and in the heat and everything else. And after that, we came back here to Colorado, checked things out, and then headed back only to find out his wife had died. So here he was, completely paralyzed, and his wife had just died. Well, he was very, very despondent. And the only thing that I remember was that since he had so many stories and his wife had always asked him to write down his stories, I said, "Well, Ed, let me write them. Let me write the book for you." And he just kind of looked up and said, "Really?" And I said, yeah, let me do it. So took a year and a half, but it came out very well received. He had a lot of customers, and word got around after the shop was closed that at least they'd have something to remember the store by and remember him by. So I was quite pleased. It's still being sold down there at the Shell Museum down there in a local bookstore, and I sell copies too from time to time. But he was extremely pleased, and he would even sell copies out of his wheelchair. Bless his heart. Just a real amazing guy. It's one of these that come into your life very rarely, but you learn so much from them. And you grow because of them. And he was one like that. So.
Sounds like he was a treasure.
Definitely. He was the biggest treasure.
Yeah. And so the book, you say that he was filled with stories he had.
Oh, yeah. Well, what I would do is I'd go over to his nursing home and with a tape recorder, and I'd ask him a couple questions, and we'd go through his photo albums. And eventually the story came about, and it was fun to do. It was a labor of love, if you don't mind the expression. you know, at times it became a little tedious because his diving partner, I'd contact him, and he said, no, that wasn't at this island, it was some other island, and so forth. So, that was the little minutia, but overall it was great. And they even had a seashell named after him. He had never seen it, but I got a picture out of the internet, and so I put it in the back cover of his book. And he was thrilled. It's a scientific name for him. So it was great. It was quite an honor. But he was definitely a great person.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it strikes me on two levels. One is we're talking. His name is Ed,
right?
And his story in particular, because I think it's what really fascinates people. That's why we read biographies and autobiographies.
Yeah. Yeah.
We want to know about people and their life stories. And someone as incredulous as this, and incredulous in a positive way, as you pointed out that. This is one of those rare individuals who come into your life and say, oh my God, this guy's like an icon.
Yeah.
So you're telling his story, but then is it also kind of, and maybe I'm overstating it, encyclopedic in terms of like seashells. So if you want to know specifics, sure. So I just want to learn more on the scientific level.
One of the things about the last half of the book is a collection of his articles that he wrote for a local shopper's guide down in Sanibel and Captiva on individual shells. So those in itself is really are really quite interesting to read.
Uh-huh.
But he had a collection of bottles and fossils too, and he just branched out into different areas. He had an old cannon there at one time, and it was just an old guns. He had an old German gun that predated the Kentucky long rifle that he sold, and Super Crocs, and I can't imagine Neanderthal tools, and
I could just see him if they, because they've gone in and dug up, or not dug up because they're under the ocean, but the Spanish galleons.
He had a friend come into the store and said, and I didn't know about this till I had almost finished the book, and I happened to find an article he'd written somewhere else. And I said, Ed, you didn't tell me about this. And he says, yeah, well, I'm still kind of leery about it. But he and a friend went on the east coast of Florida with the underwater metal detectors, and he found some Spanish pieces of eight, also one gold coin. Mm-hmm. And he very tentatively would put it out in his display cabinet one at a time, because he was concerned that because of Florida laws, salvage laws and stuff like that, that he might have to pay taxes or actually to give up this treasure find. But that never happened. But, it's an interesting part about him that he was really hesitant to talk about.
Yeah. Well, it sounds as that he had this deep love, of course, for that.
Oh, yeah.
And, and was willing to go exploring, get down there, because that's a treasure trove. That was all part of the Spanish Main back 300-400 years ago.
Yeah. They were, Spain was becoming bankrupt, and they needed gold to continue to fight their wars, I guess. So they went down into Mexico and places like that. And then as they were hauling the gold back, every once in a while they run into a hurricane and the ships
or
would
the
be
British
lost.
Pirate ships.
Yeah, something like that too. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. Captain Hook, whoever.
Right, yeah. Uh-huh. So anyway, there's I did actually consult with the one man who actually told Mel Fisher where the Atocha was. The Atocha was one, I can't remember the exact date, in 1600s, big haul of silver and gold and jewelry. But Mel was looking in the wrong place, and this other gentleman said, no, according to all the records in Spain, this ship went down at such and such a place. So Mel got all the credit for it, but it was really the guy I talked to that told him where to dig.
Direct them over there.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. I see that, and I listening and hearing his story. Then, It has extensions on it that goes beyond, you know, like the seashells thing, which is, you know, fascinating unto itself. But there's so many others. So when you say Neptune's treasures, I mean, this is a panoply of wealth.
It is, too. And I always said he had nine lives because he got hit by a train at a railroad crossing one time. And another time he was diving. He rented a diving tank, and the people had not put the air in the tank. So he got down to the bottom of the water, and all of a sudden the gauge said nothing.
Oh.
So when you come up, you run a great risk of having the bends. Mm-hmm. And so he just had to do it. And fortunately, he mm-hmm. did all right. Another time, he was out diving in the water, and the boat that was it took them out there had left, mm-hmm. and was nowhere around. Well, he comes up and he doesn't see anybody. Well, apparently the boat ladies had to use the restroom or something, so they went, you know, 10 miles away or something. But he was really upset. So, but I mean, all that's in the book, and he it's just so many little vignettes, I guess, about his life. He just lived such a full, rich life, and just
Which serves as a model for the rest of us.
Oh, you bet. Yeah, and he was so enthusiastic all his life. He just, you know, he just had this zest for life and to find things and to learn about things. Just a wonderful guy.
Yeah, and it for me, Reese, it's that idea, that concept of curiosity, that you are curious about the other end. You know, what will I find here? You know, it's kind of like when you're out hiking and what's over that next hill sort of thing. Only for him, it's like, okay, I'm going to dig, you know, dive over here. I'll dive over there. And you never know what you're going to come up. You might come up with nothing. Yeah. On the other hand, you might just come up with a gold coin, you know.
Oh, you bet.
From 16 whatever with King Philip II on or something, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's amazing. Some of these shells are quite rare, and it depends on how many they are. But you know, he actually sold some for quite a bit of money. So. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. he also found the world's record horse conch, and the photograph's in the picture. Mm-hmm. And he never told me what he actually sold it for. But then the person who bought it turned around and donated it to our shell museum down in Sanibel. So it's still on display there.
So there is a museum there.
I think it is probably purported to be the world's only museum that devoted completely to shells. It's a fantastic museum. If any of your listening audience ever goes to Sanibel, make sure that they check out the Sanibel Shell Museum down there.
Oh, that sounds fun.
It's amazing. You just have no idea of the variety of shells, the colors, just incredible.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And you know, all the different species, if you will.
Exactly.
You
know. Exactly.
You know, I just get intrigued. Just, you know, it's not something that's been on my radar, but sitting here talking to you, I'm going like, okay, next time in South Florida, okay, I got to keep this on my mind.
You bet.
And go there and just, you know, explore that.
Oh, yeah. It's well worth the visit. Traffic's getting a bit horrendous down on Sanibel, but if you pick a time and a time of the year and a time of the day, it's well worth trying to find that shell museum and going in there.
That sounds awesome. Well, that's fantastic. And it's not your only work.
No.
Another one is Sunrise.
Well, that was the first one. And I guess the other thing, I learned a lot about it. I had one printer on the island, and then she became sick. So I went to some other printer down in Naples, Florida, that eventually came out with a book. And they did very well on it. But I also learned one thing, was that you always back up your hard drives.
No.
I learned the hard way. I had an old computer, and I thought, okay, I've got this, you know, 2-year-old external hard drive. So I said, I'll put it on that. Well, I did, and that thing fried. I said, I can't believe it. My old computer's still working, but it's fried. Well, they shipped it off to Seagate, I think, and I believe it was either Texas or California, and it took months. They actually had to build a machine to read the disk, because it's sort of like records, where the vinyl records, if they were warped, but this thing would have to go up and down with the, you know, with the little grooves or whatever. But anyway, that took a long time, and I was just sick because I thought I'd lost it all, but they did retrieve it. But anyway, so I learned that lesson, and it was just an interesting experience to do this. But I did, for instance, learn about, you know, chapter breaks. So I always knew in his store that the phone was constantly ringing. So what I would do is I put a little symbol of a telephone ring and had a little joke, and that would end the chapter, and then a new topic would begin there. But anyway, it was pretty cute. I mean, these were, for the most part, made up little phone call question and answer things, little cute short things. But it was a way to put in a chapter break on it.
Sure, little glyph that way, you know, bring a little humor to it.
Oh, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So it was fun.
So you became a real pro with Neptune's Treasure, and then you launched into.
Yeah, well, then there was a brief hiatus, I guess you call it, a couple years, and I decided, well, I do like humor so much, so I started the first of a trilogy called Sunrise at Sanitarium, and I hope to do High Noon and Sunset. But anyway, this dealt with sort of a Thurber character like Walter Mitty, and he can't help his fantasy. He's fantasizing. His wife is getting a little fed up with it because he kind of flips out periodically, and so he goes to a psychiatrist and puts him into some sort of regression analysis or some sort of thing, and he relives a little bit about his childhood. Then they recommend that he live out one of his fantasies, so he says, okay, well, I'll go to an island off the coast of Venezuela called Sanitarium. Well, I won't say much more than that, but there's a lot of people that he encounters from where his original home is in Vermont, and they appear also down in this island. So it's also the fantasy, his main fantasy is a girl named Rachel. And she's in a little different time era herself, but anyway, it's not so easy to change your fantasies. So,
yeah.
But beyond that, I probably
is
won't
this a real place?
It.
Sanitarium.
No,
I was going to say, because that's isn't that kind of like a play on?
Oh, Sanitarium. Exactly.
Because it was so funny because I was right at one time I was writing it. Oh, on my Facebook page, and I actually wrote it as one word, and I went no. And I had to get it. Oh, that's funny.
Oh yeah. Well, they take the couple main characters take a tour over there, and there's several islands there named after an explorer, Gaspé, and they have a beginning and a middle, and then the senior ones always retire at Las Gaspé. So, you know, another little pun.
That's where your humor comes in.
Yeah,
there
but I mean, the whole thing is just rife with little puns and innuendos and things like that. And I enjoyed so much writing it, you know, and I hope other people will enjoy reading.
Is there a little
so.
Bit of you in that?
I'm not gonna say. I don't want to admit to any of that because if one chooses to read it, I don't want to say that I based it on myself.
Right.
For various reasons that'll become obvious when they read it. So.
Yeah, and the elements of that humor that comes in and those little, like you say, vignettes or whatever.
Yeah, and I started, I kind of thought, well, I'd make it a little satire on Sanibel itself, but then I thought, well, I'm still living there. I don't want to get burned at the stake coming over the causeway. So I figured I'd make it a fictitious island way.
Yeah, I don't know if they would have burned. That's a New England thing, burning at the stake. You
know,
if you were up in Salem or something.
Yeah, but you understand a lot of New Yorkers have moved down to Florida, so they probably brought some of the old.
They could have, you know, fed you to the alligators or something.
Yeah, something very easily. Yeah, we had one in our house was right next to a small lake. We had 11 and a half foot alligator that stayed there, and I nicknamed it Nadia Kamenicha. And she was, kind of a really throwback. It was just amazing to see this huge thing come out and just crawl right through our backyard and mm-hmm. across the street to another little wetland area. So.
Mm-hmm. And you kept your distance, of course.
Most of the time. Uh-huh. I accidentally got in a situation where we were over at our neighbor's. She had a little raised patio right next to some cattails by the pond, and her dog flipped a toy over the chain link fence, and I said, I'll go get it. So I go around there, bend over, and there's Nadia. Her head bobs up out of the water, and she is no more than about 3 feet, and not even 3 feet from me.
Oh.
And I said that, and there was another four-letter word after the O that I
voiced. And then you did it.
I think I had to throw those trousers away.
Yeah.
But anyway, I backed up along the fence and then finally got up into that raised little patio area, and then she started coming out again. And my wife said, well, I wonder, what her reactions are. So she took a palm frond and leaned over the poor and touched its nose, and it just went just like a mouse trap, just as fast as a mouse trap. And
right.
So they're incredibly strong. So you definitely don't want to fool around
with
them.
And they're fast.
They're actually very fast. Supposedly they could outrun a horse at a short distance. So I don't know. I wouldn't want to be trying that. But
yeah, I would imagine that's the being up here in the mountains. There's two different ways two different critters. One is the bear.
Yeah.
And you don't want to outrun the bear. You just curl up in a ball. Whereas if it's a mountain lion, then you get bigger. You kind of go after it almost like you get aggressive. I imagine the alligator, you do exactly that. You just start backing up.
Up for sure, or do the old zigzag method. I don't know how well. But we actually had several people killed by alligators on that island over the years that we stayed there. But the bear thing, too, reminded me of a story of two guys in a tent that were there, and a bear starts ripping their canvas, and one guy says, we need to get out of here, and the other guy starts putting on his tennis shoes, and he says, why are you doing that? You can't outrun that bear. And the guy says, all I have to do is outrun you.
They're right there.
So it's a kind of a similar thing, but definitely want to keep in shape when you're being pursued like that.
So the sunrise at Sanitarium, you have the sunrise done. That's published, and it's going to be part of a trilogy.
That's what I hope. Yeah, I'm working on the high noon part there, and there's enough material. I don't know, these characters are ones that are sort of waiting for me to keep them going. It's like the first one is not a cliffhanger, but the story doesn't end there at all. But there's a lot of intrigue. It's a lot of humorous intrigue there. So
yeah, and by the way, our listening audience, this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT LPFM 102.7, 103.9. On the air here in Idaho Springs in the center of the universe here in Clear Creek County. This is the Rabbit Hole, and we have Reese Llewellyn here talking about his works and on the Writer's Talk segment of this here. So Reese, did you initially start off to write a trilogy, or did you write the first one and then that? Then it sprung you into? How did you?
Well, the first one ends up at 340 pages, and I could have gone on and on and on, but nobody would buy a $500 book or something.
A 500 page book.
A 500 page, either one. Well, actually, my third one is 500 pages, but
probably needs a little editing then.
Well, not this one, but anyway, I just had to stop it at that point because I just could have gone on and on and on with it. No, I think I had intended that I really needed to break it into three. And plus, I was kind of thinking of the Sunrise at Campobello type of thing, and I said, okay, well, I'll do three. So,
yeah, my experience was that I had initially thought to write just a one-time novel on this particular Sisyphus wins. Mm-hmm. But then after a good number of people read it, they go, okay, I want to know what happens next,
sure.
You know, to the different characters are in, you know, what happened in there, because there's like a gap of 20 years or whatever, mm-hmm. too, you know. And I said, okay, you know. So then that's what, you know, encouraged the idea in me, promoted the idea in me to write a trilogy. So, you know, I'm moving on, but that's a whole other thing. That's why I was curious about yours, if you had already, you know, planned that out or not.
I just knew I had to stop it and break it into three, and because it was just going on. There was so much material, and I was enjoying it way too much to stop it at once.
So this is going to be a lighter version of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Probably, I would say. There's a lot of cuckoos in this one, I'll tell you that, in this nest. It's pretty crowded. So
yeah, so you're the alternate, the of Ken Kesey, who wrote Cuckoo's Nest, you know.
Probably. And there's a lot of kind of Thurber influence in there, too, with the fantasy and also with the the little domestic fun sniping at each other and stuff like that. But it's a... there's CIAs in it, the military's in it, post office, a little bit of church, and it's all being tongue-in-cheek type of fun. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it covers a wide range of people.
It sounds like fun.
It's enjoyable.
To be able to escape in a pleasant way, you know, in a fun story.
You can't take it seriously. It's silly. You really have to be in a frame of mind to just be able to laugh and relax. And it's just so outrageous. Mm-hmm. You don't look at it as something that's supposed to really, really make sense. It's a little bit of Doug Adams kind of stuff with the universe deal that he wrote. Mm-hmm.
That sounds like fun to, you know, really get into.
I think it really is. So,
well, and then you, Henry Fulton.
Yeah.
What's this guy here? I'm kind of intrigued about him.
He was a very, very brilliant individual. He was would have been my great uncle, and he was born back 1867. And he in North Carolina, he went on to law school in Washington, D.C., and I think he was very much interested in politics, but the Chicago World's Fair came up in 1893, and he really wanted to go to that, so he had a little bit of reservations about doing that, making the trip, but anyways, he did go. And then he was in a hurry one day, and he's running down the tracks. I think the rest of the ground was kind of muddy. But anyway, he was struck from behind by one of their little commuter trains and died a couple hours later. So he only lived to be 26 years old. But his younger brother was my grandfather, and they so loved each other. He told my mother then to keep all of Fulton's letters. So, and she dutifully did that. And then when she passed away, then I inherited the letters, and I thought, well, you know, they make a fantastic story. Mm-hmm. One of the things, he was on a debate team at Columbia Law School in Washington, and one of the judges on the debate was Williams Jennings Bryan, which was pretty amazing, the connection there. Mm-hmm. But so anyway, I decided I would compile these letters and make them available to, you know, first and foremost my own relatives. But my ultimate goal is to find descendants of the people that wrote letters to Fulton,
yes,
and say, hey, do you want to know more about your grandfather, your grandmother? And I think through some of the genealogy programs available, I may just be able to do something like that. But what I did also in the book is, when there were things that I didn't really understand, or events or people or places that I didn't know about. I prepared over 200 endnotes, and a lot of them have the photographs of these particular people involved in it. Sarah Bernhardt is one that you may be very familiar with, but she's mentioned in one of the letters where Fulton went and saw her in the theater. And a lot of these people, Julia Marlowe was another actress at the time, but Sherman's brother is in here too. And a lot of the, if you want to call them the newsmakers of the day, whether they're politicians, actors, actresses, it was really a fascinating story in itself about these, the connection from these letters and saying, well, you know, so-and-so is on the stage tonight, or they, Fulton would go to the congressional hearings and, you know, talk about some of these people that he heard. So I went to the internet and added that to the book. So all in all, between the letters and the end note, so to speak, it's almost 500 pages long. So,
oh, that's awesome.
But it's really quite fascinating. I found it fascinating anyway, and my relatives have been exclaiming its virtues now, which is good to hear. So,
oh, yeah. Yeah, it keeps you good with the family.
Yeah, and copies in the Library of Congress and the Martin Luther King Library and a couple of the Historical Society libraries in North Carolina. So it's...
Well, these are, you know, because I used to teach history. I have a minor in American history and the use of primary sources. And if you know enough, you know, those of us that studied history about that time period, for example, because we're focusing on the late 19th century, that's really the rise of the industrial age.
Right. It's during the Reconstruction period after the Civil War.
Post-Civil War, Reconstruction there. So a lot was happening there in the South. The Chicago Fire was shortly before that as well. Mark Twain just had come out with Huck Finn back in 1884. And so he was the big celeb at that time, too. And so there was all these currents going on. But the media that you use, the medium that you use here, two of them. One is the primary sources, but also the photographs. And in this day and age here with internet and instant, you know, we got our iPhones, we take pictures like this. We just take it for granted. My nephew and his wife, niece, just had their baby today.
Oh, very
I already have a picture of it you know, on him. So John and Tammy, hey, shout out to you. You know, he already texted me a picture of him. You know, I mean, instantaneous there.
Just in time for Father's Day.
There you go. For John. There you go.
Right.
And so to look back at that time period, and, you know, and I just kind of, when you were flipping through the pages there, looking at those things, and I don't know, they call them lithographs or whatever, you know, that the photography, the technology of it.
Oh, it's
and
amazing.
There's such still shots and... They're formal in large part. You know, you always have, you know, even the early 20th century, the husband, the father was always sitting down. The wife stood next to him with her hand on the shoulder and nobody smiled.
Nobody smiled.
That was our culture then. I mean, it's, and to look at that is just, I mean, it's an amazing, you know, time capsule. Whether you're in that Llewellyn family or not, it doesn't matter, that this is richness. Yeah. That we can gain from.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a type of a project that I actually, again, I enjoyed doing, and I putting in the footnotes was icing on the cake, I think, because it made these connections, and it made it all real. I mean, he was living in a time, and he saw these people, and it's just pretty amazing.
Yeah, bring it, because your roots are there.
Exactly.
You know, you say you could trace your family's roots back, to
this,
the 18th
century? Well, actually, this was on the my mother's side was Griffin.
Okay.
In case Faye Griffin happens to be listening today. She might be related. But anyway, it was Griffin's, and there was a Tom Griffin who came over to fight in the Revolutionary War.
Okay.
So we can at least... trace it back that far, if not further. There's some strong possibility that we're related to Jefferson Davis, and there's some connection to Pocahontas, and I mean, it really gets kind of far out there, but I think there's better documentation on my mother's side of the family than my father's.
So. Okay. And I didn't say his full name when I introduced it. It's Henry Fulton Griffin.
Yeah,
Griffin is the last name there. And I got, you know, as far as Fulton there. But, And, no, that's awesome. That's a lot of work right there, you know, putting that together.
Well, what's rewarding, too, I've already sent copies of the original letters to a couple people, and they were very appreciative because they said, you know, we didn't know that much about our grandfather.
Yeah.
And so it's being able to track them down was very rewarding. And mm-hmm. just because I don't, when something happens to me, I just don't want these to be tossed, you know. I'd like to get them to the people that, first, it's their property. If you're a descendant of a person, those letters actually are property of the descendants. But right. if I can't find those, I would definitely donate them to historical societies.
Or the school, you say he went to Columbia in...
Law school in Washington, D.C.
Is that still...
Yeah, that's still
there. I'm familiar with Columbia University in New York. So that's one of their alumnus.
Yeah.
I think they would love, I mean, if it goes beyond the family, you know, check with the university.
Yeah, that's a possibility, definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have his diplomas. I've got a lot of land deeds. I guess my grandfather was sort of instrumental in handling a lot of deeds in North Carolina, and some of them go back to the late 1700s anyway. So mm-hmm. I've got to find some repository for them, too, as well. You know.
Sure. Yeah, because in this history here, you know, in 20, 30 years, but you and I are going to be gone.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Okay, so what do we leave behind?
Exactly.
And, I mean, these are authentic relics.
Yeah.
You know, you talk about, when we go back to our first work here, we were talking about Neptune's treasures and all the fossils and everything, too.
Oh, yeah.
Those are, that's evidence, the story of what happened back in that land before time, whether it's the Spanish galleons or the, you know, the fish, whatever, you know. And this is part of our human history, too, our fossils.
One of the things that I found interesting is when we worked in that show, we got to know a lot of the other dealers that would come in, and he'd buy certain things from them, one of whom lives in California, and apparently... Pre-Columbus, there were some Chinese ships that came over to the Pacific side, obviously, and one of them apparently went up the Sacramento River, and it got stranded.
Mm-hmm.
So my friend, a friend of this of Ed's too, they did some core drilling. They found wood that from trees that don't grow here,
right?
And they grow in China.
Mm-hmm.
And they found pottery shards down in San Francisco Bay. They located with a, magnetometer, an outline of about 40 feet of a ship, which would have been the size of this Chinese ship that came over. But it's on private property, and the farmer doesn't want it dug up. But History Channel and all these other people are... just chomping at the bit to get in there because that would completely change our history as far as the earlier...
Columbus didn't, you know, discover America after all.
Exactly,
Mm-hmm.
Well, then the other stories of Vikings, for instance, L'Anse Meadows up in Newfoundland was a place where they were replacing the nails that had rusted on the journeys over, and... it is very possible there are other sites where the Vikings may have come further down North America, but they haven't discovered it yet. But never say never about learning.
To separate, you know, because you're exactly right about the Vikings and coming down, and they may have gotten as far as south as, like, I think Massachusetts. There's mm-hmm. some evidence there, you know, certainly up in Newfoundland and Nova Scotia. There's certainly settlements there that they've dug out, excavated. But then be careful, you know, we have the Minnesota Vikings, you know, because somehow there was like, okay, that's a fraud, you know.
Exactly.
Talk about fake news.
Right.
But, you know, it goes back, and the more we learn, you know, about that. Well, that would go back. My mind's jumping here. Thor Heyerdahl.
Sure.
You ever followed his work.
Right. Gontiki. Yeah.
Gontiki.
Right.
You know, and could have, you know, could the Egyptians have sailed across? You know, you look at the shape of South America at one time, back billions of years ago, it was one big landmass.
Right.
And then there was this split, and South America tucks up very nicely with Africa. And it's not that far, really, when you think of
it. Oh, yeah.
You know, and could they have come over in the reed boats or something?
Right.
And same with the Polynesians. Could they have traveled all the way, you know, to Easter Island and then all the way to South America? The answer is yeah, they could have.
Oh, exactly.
You know, so this is intriguing stuff. You know,
yeah. That, what we noticed, too, we've been over to Tibet and China, and you look at some of the features of their people, and you look at the ones of our North American Indians, or you look at the ones further south, and wow, a lot of similarities. And one of the things that I found was kind of interesting, the Welsh, and I can't remember the name of the little boat, the Welsh, a corgi or something, something like that. And it's made out of leather. And it's a little fishing boat, not more than about 5 or 6 feet long by maybe 3 or 4 feet wide. And we were over in Tibet, and there was a boat just like it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how does that information come over? How do they... Is it independent thinking, or what happens in that situation?
Well, there's a couple theories there. One is that there was, first of all, international trade already happening at that time. The other is that it goes back to the Jungian think there of the collective unconscious in terms of these notions, ideas were, you know, surfacing at similar times in disparate parts of the world. You know, so you look at the pyramids in Central Mesoamerica, okay, and then compare them to the ones, certainly in Egypt, the ones we're familiar with. Did they bring that art, the Mayans, did they inherit that, bring that, or, you know, descendants of the Egyptians in some way? Or was it kind of like the, you know, kind of crazy, or spontaneous combustion, but nonetheless, that they organically arose from cultures at that time, the concept of pyramidal, you know, there, we don't know, you know, but it's fun. It's great. You know, if you're curious to conjecture about,
don't want to rule anything out, any possibilities.
Oh, keep exploring. So you go back, like you say, to Neptune's treasures there.
Yeah.
What history, what, you know, is bringing up here, that treasure there. It, to me, it's beyond those seashells and, you know, little fossil things that he's bringing up. But what's the story behind us?
Yeah.
Our ultimate story of mankind, of humanity. How did we come about here? And, you know, why are we here? Different races, you know? And, I mean, it's just, we really don't know.
Yeah.
We think we
exactly.
do, but we don't.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, it's fun stuff here.
Yeah.
So, we only got a couple minutes left, and people want to get your work.
Okay.
How do they do that, Reese?
Well, if you're not in Florida for Ed's book, then the only place that you can get them right now is through my own website, which is www.thesnowbirdpress.com. And I started that, of course, when we were going back and forth as snowbirds to Florida in the winter. But it's www.thesnowbirdpress.com. And information about each of the books is up there, and with ordering instructions. So, and actually what we'll do today, if your audience is interested, I'll offer free shipping on any book that they order if they just mention this radio program.
So, oh, very nice.
So
there you go. So thesnowbirdpress.com.
Yeah.
Okay. And
yeah.
then if you can't remember that, just email me and I'll get
sure.
that to you. I'll get you that information.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Know, and
yeah.
patch it through over here to Reese also.
Yeah.
And so that's great. Yeah, you get the free shipping on it.
Sure.
Because they're like fun works, all of them.
Well, they're different.
Yeah.
They're different in their own ways, and even the one on my great uncle, people that are interested in history and Reconstruction era, and just the knowing the personal feelings of these people, and how his parents really sacrificed a lot to put both of them through college, and just in the It was, you know, a little tough on people down there in the South after the Civil War. They didn't have much, so it's a real struggle. So that's a kind of an interesting story too. But they're all different in their ways. But.
Sounds like you're having fun.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it. I've got a couple other ones besides the trilogy. I wanted to do one. I had years ago collected newspaper clippings from an old antique store in Washington, D.C. I went up in the attic, and they had original Matthew Brady photographs up there, which they eventually donated to the Smithsonian because they were priceless. But also in there, a person had taken all the newspaper clippings of Stanley searching for Livingston.
Yeah.
And these came out of the New York, I think it's Herald Tribune. So I bought these two books that he had just pasted them in, and I'd like to do something like that and put that out. And then there's a book that I did sort of revised on Welsh immigrants to Colorado back in the 1800s, and I'd like to try to get that published. So there's, I'm still busy.
Yeah,
you know,
a couple of things jump in mind when you talk about the Welsh and the. There's a fun movie. It's called Pride, and it deals with. It's made in England a couple of years ago, and it's based on a true story. Back in the early '80s, when the Welsh miners went on strike, and Margaret Thatcher was determined to crush the unions, and the gay and lesbians in London. Came, you know, and started supporting them, and so they formed this bond, you know. These, you know. So when the gays and lesbians show up in Wells, they're going like, "Oh, you know, one of these." But it's a really powerful story. But what I bring is that there's this one character who's Welsh, and he talks about the coal that's dug in Wells, and there's this vein that begins in Spain. Travels up along the French coast into Wales, across the Atlantic Ocean, and into Pennsylvania. And it is like the purest coal you could dig, whatever. And when I think of that, I mean, it's just like, you know, we're talking thousands of miles, you know, this how this coal was made way back billions of years ago. But once again, the interconnectedness of us all, you know, and through a coal vein, itself and how the Welsh miners could connect to the Spanish or the Pennsylvania miners, if you will, and this common humanity that's here. And the other thing that strikes me too, Reese, is that listening to your stories, there's a nice article in the paper today in the Denver Post, and it's about baseball. And, you know, it springs off of the tragedy that struck, you know, earlier this week when that nutcase, you know, took aim at those congressmen. And but he brings it back to baseball because it's so significant that these events happen with, you know, location of it. And this one was about baseball on the baseball field. You know, it's our national pastime and everything too. But he talks about how we're such a fast-paced society. Everything has to happen now, now, now. And the one game that doesn't happen fast-paced is baseball. You know, I joke and say, if you can watch photosynthesis and paint dry and you're happy, you can watch baseball. But it's that encouragement to step back from our helter-skelter busy lives that everything is quick, has to be here. You know, our fast food, our, you know, internet news, all blah, 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 like this. Remember, we'll dial up. It took us forever, but we were happy with dial up. Now, man, if we don't have internet connection within seconds, we're kind of like freaking out. But to take your works and step back in time, you know, the first and the third ones there, you know, Neptune's Treasure and the one about Henry Fulton Griffin, and go back there and just step back from our own crazy busy lives and what stories are being transmitted, being carried here. And then your other work about Sanitarium, you know, a fun escape also to just, you know, you don't have to be busy. And these are like fun, great works to get into because they're thought provoking. If you have any sense of curiosity, you're going to get into stuff like this. So, you know, kudos to you. Compliments on that.
Yeah, thank you. I just didn't want, especially Ed's story, to not be told. And Fulton's the same way. I mean, here letters preserved for 125 years, and then they'd be gone. And then we had, my mother told me in their house in North Carolina, they had barrels of Civil War letters, but the barn burned down. They were all lost. So these were just a few. I mean, I shouldn't say a few, a couple hundred letters, but at least they still remain, and you still have that glimpse into the time, their lives, their hopes, their dreams. This could have been actually a romantic novel. There's people that wrote to his parents and told them how much they loved him. And I won't go into it much, but there's several women in there that just adored him. And they were great writers too in those days. I mean, all we do is email these days, but these are beautifully written letters. They're just
incredible. The art itself, the art of the letter writing is gone.
Exactly.
If you don't do it anymore.
Exactly. So I felt I did a good service, at least to my cousins, in preserving these, and other people have actually enjoyed reading them too. Just it's a glimpse into a past that'll never be back. We just don't realize that anymore, what we've lost as far as social graces and just taking the time to write a letter to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah. Step back and maybe take a deep breath, and we can start refinding our common humanity and, you know, stop.
I hope
the crazy.
We can. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Thank you, Reese. This has been an amazing conversation.
Well, you're most welcome. I appreciate being on your show very much.
You got it. And so one more time, your website is
www.thesnowbird.com.
Awesome. All right. So Reese Llewellyn, everyone. It's a good thing we got the spit guard right.
I know. I got that cover over the mic there. We're all set. Yeah.
Otherwise, Dave freaks out on stuff like that.
Exactly. Yeah.
But, all right, everyone. Hey, this is Jerry Fabiano, KYGT LP FM 102.7, 103.9. Gone into a little bit over time. That's okay. And I'm going to call it good for the rest of the day here. I will be back, though, in a couple of weeks on July 1st. We'll have another guest in Writer's Talk. And in the meantime, let's keep enjoying the summer weather, and let's start being really nice to one another and compassionate and understanding, and take time out and, you know, maybe dive into some of Reese's works here and, you know, and have some fun. All right. We'll be back in a couple. In the meantime, take care now. All right. Bye.